A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's edition of The Group Chat. I am news correspondent here at Virgin Media News, Richard Chambers, joined by my fellow news correspondent, Zara King.
Hello, how are you?
And political correspondent, Gavin Riley.
Richard, how are you?
Good, yeah, not too bad. Obviously, the news agenda is still very much being dominated by the events of a couple of weeks ago in Dublin, both the stabbing and the subsequent riots that followed. Quick update on the five-year-old girl who remains in a critical condition in hospital at the time of recording on Wednesday. The girl's mother on a GoFundMe set up to benefit the girl in question said, "Dear all, thank you all so much for your incredible gesture and kindness that you have shown our family during these troubled times. Your thoughts, prayers and generosity have and will go a long way. Our little girl has shown incredible strength and is still here with us. We don't know yet what lies ahead as it is still early, but she is resilient and limitations will not stop her. Thank you so much. All the love we can give." Investigations into that incident still ongoing as we speak, and also into the riots that followed. But Helen McEntee, Gavin, has survived the political fallout of this for now, at least.
In a way, almost more reinforced and reassured than she was 2 weeks ago before the whole thing kicked off. And this is sometimes the results or the outcome of confidence motions, that not alone does the government inevitably always win them anyway, because that's how governments work. If you have a majority in the Dáil, that's how you get to stay in government. But the volume of the victory, I think, took a lot of observers by surprise yesterday. The vote on Tuesday night, 83 votes to 63. And one might think that when there were so many questions about the standard of policing, the resourcing of policing, Helen McEntee's hands-off approach to the conduct of policing, the hands-off approach of An Garda Síochána to far-right protests, there's a lot of reason to think that Helen McEntee might have been in some notional trouble, or that the margin might have been a little bit closer. In a way, this is almost the best case scenario for the government at the end of all of this, because once the Dáil has decided Helen McEntee is safe in post, there's basically politically nowhere else for it to go. Like, really telling that at Leaders' Questions on Wednesday, the day after the night before, Sinn Féin was back to talking about the cost of rent and other more everyday bread and butter issues, not talking about the fallout of 2 weeks ago. So Helen McEntee, oddly secured. And also, one thing I did notice about the Dáil debate was that ordinarily in motions of confidence, you can have a situation where the speaking slots are dominated by the party colleagues of the person being discussed. So previously there's been a motion of no confidence in Dara O'Brien. Most of the speakers would have been from Fianna Fáil, saying Fianna Fáil is doing X, Y and Z, or Fine Gael is doing X, Y and Z, or the Greens, whatever. It really telling that there was like a real unity of purpose among the three coalition parties on Tuesday when they were participating in that. There was no sense of she belongs to another party, but we're shoring her up because we have to. There was like actual endorsement of what the agenda was. And a lot of Fine Gael types basically thought it was like one of the best days of their lives, because they just got to spend 2.5 hours in the Dáil just shouting broadsides at Sinn Féin and questioning their allegiance to law and order.
Yeah, and I suppose like in many ways, actually, what it has done is it's totally reaffirmed Helen McEntee's position. It's, as you say, it's sort of strengthened it, actually, because she has that backing. It was interesting last week. Sinn Féin took their time to decide, though, whether or not they were going to call that motion, didn't they? Because we thought we'd get an answer on Thursday. And I know I was at Leinster House on Thursday and they were sort of hemming and hawing about whether they would do it. Do you think maybe in some way Sinn Féin might regret calling that motion?
Possibly as quickly as they did, because firstly, there is that sense that now that the Dáil has affirmed her position, there is basically nowhere else for it to go. That short of there being any other major disorder in Dublin, it's kind of hard to know where it would go from here. But there is a school of thought that Sinn Féin found itself boxed into this corner because there was the controversy over the use of the photograph of someone on the doorstep beside Gaelscoil Cloisteáin de Vere, the doorstep in which the stabbings took place the previous week. A photograph of somebody slumped over drinking a can of beer. This was presented, tweeted by Mary Lou. The man was semi-anonymous, but there was nothing done to try and anonymise him or make him unidentifiable. Tweeted by Mary Lou McDonald as some evidence of poor policing in the aftermath of the attack. And then a photograph of the same man held up in the Dáil chamber by Louise O'Reilly. That was so widely panned that quite a number of people, including those that were on Sinn Féin's side ultimately, think that the whole thing was a ruse, ultimately an attempt by Sinn Féin to try and reclaim the agenda, that they were playing defence on something of a propaganda own goal that some people thought they needed to fire off some other big bazooka to distract the debate. Now, whether that is totally true or not, I don't know. But it's interesting that even Sinn Féin's own sympathisers think that it might have been a bit of an own goal, and that the motion to unseat Helen McEntee was a response to reset the narrative a bit. Richard, you're not too impressed.
Like some of that, even in Gavin, what you're sort of saying about some Fine Gael people almost thought it was the best day of their lives, kind of given the subject matter of what this was all called about, I kind of find that a bit... That's important. Pretty lame. That's really bad stuff, to be fair, and speaks to a lot of cynicism that a lot of people feel about politics, that everything is just purely down to political points when it comes down to it, as opposed to what's actually, you know, a very, very serious matter.
Yeah.
So that's not great in terms of the seriousness with which people take the matters at hand, whether that's, you know, policing and safety in Dublin, the far right, or generally just, you know, all of the other issues which have come up in justice over the last number of weeks and months as well. So yeah, I do think that it was probably, I think people in Sinn Féin would probably admit that maybe they pulled the trigger on it too quickly, because I remember it was actually on the Friday, the day after the knife attack and the riots, that Mary Lou McDonald was out on Parnell Square and she was saying that she had no confidence in the Garda Commissioner and she had no confidence in Justice Minister Helen McEntee, and called on both of them to resign. So that was very immediate. So there is an element of maybe that was a bad idea. Although a lot of people, you know, in the two government parties, well, the two major government parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, were not happy at all with how Helen McEntee had performed. So some of them were privately sort of saying, well, I don't know how much road she has left to run here, given the multiple controversies in justice up until this point, and then something as serious as what happened, you know, on the 23rd of November.
I think there was a sense, though, in Sinn Féin, from even speaking to Louisa O'Reilly, say, last Thursday, which would have been 1 week on from the riot, at the time, you know, when they were trying to consider whether or not they called the motion, there definitely was a sense that they wanted accountability from someone in power about what had happened in the loss of control in Dublin City, and that there definitely was a feeling that, despite the fact that the day before, remember, on the Wednesday, the commissioner had been before the Oireachtas Justice Committee for about 3 hours. Louisa O'Reilly was like, 3 hours before the Oireachtas Committee is not enough. You know, we still need accountability. The truth of the matter was that, you know, there was a loss of control
and
there.
And what other scalp do you go looking for then in those circumstances?
Because then the two at the top of the table.
And it's not up to the Dáil to decide whether the Garda Commissioner gets to stay in the post. And if Sinn Féin announced that they were moving a motion of no confidence in Drew Harris, then what happens the next time there's a general election? Sinn Féin come in and they've already declared they don't like the guy running the guards. Then suddenly the guy running the guards is forced to resign almost immediately. And that's a situation you can't really get into. So there was nobody else to go looking for, to go hunting for, other than Helen McEntee. On your point, Richard, about how tone deaf it might be for Fine Gael to sort of treat a debate like that as something of a victory lap. An interesting illustration about how the public and politicians move in totally different lanes is that the public will have seen the debate on Tuesday as being entirely centred on what happened on the streets 2 weeks ago and the fallout and whether it should have been seen coming. When government sees a confidence motion, what they see is an opportunity to talk about the last 3 years. There was an election in 2020. Here's all the stuff we've done since then. Look how many more guards there are. Look how many more overtime hours there are. Look at all the kit that we're buying them. Look at all the legislation we've passed. They don't treat it as a debate on the last 2 weeks. They treat it as a debate on 3 years.
Is that a mistake on their part then, surely?
Well, that's kind of a joke, to be honest, because literally the matter at hand is a vote of no confidence in the Justice Minister, which was called in the aftermath of the Dublin stabbing and riots. So for any party, and I think there was an element of politics being played by Sinn Féin as well in doing that, and they've had multiple no confidence motions now at this point in time which have fallen flat in their face. Like, to go on and just raffle on about, you know, there was a lot of, and Fine Gael were very quick as well in terms of what they were cutting and putting up online from the debate itself, and there was a lot. There was a lot of, we showed them, you know, what we're made of.
You
we
guys, show, law and order.
Yeah,
we'll show you.
So, like, that's not, that, I just don't think that's great. It does paint a picture to me, at least, that there's a, like, if you were the average person sitting and watching that, that again, the issue and the matter at hand is completely lost by people just, you know, boo politicking in the Dáil. What do you think, Zara?
Yeah, and I think as well, like, to kind of look at it more broadly from, as you said, Richard, the public's perspective, like, you have to look at it and ask yourself, does the public have confidence in the capital city? And does the public have confidence in spending time now in the capital city in the wake of all of this and all the conversations that have taken place? And, you know, all of us have received messages from people over the last couple of weeks. And some of the messages that come through are people saying, like, we'd normally have our shopping trip to Dublin every year. We're not going to go this year. Or people reconsidering their plans, excuse me, and changing their arrangements. So, like, I suppose what's happening inside the gates of Leinster House is one thing, but, like, actually what's happening outside and in the middle of the city centre and in the capital at this really important time of year, I don't know, there is, I mean, I hate, we say it all the time, it's cliche, there's a disconnect there, Richard. Like, there's definitely, you know, point scoring politically happening behind the gates, and outside you've got, you know, a busy time of year, people should be out celebrating, enjoying each other's company, and actually, you know, people have concerns, and that's just a very real thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, I think it was on Saturday or Sunday, he was out, I was working the weekend, and he said that it was all a stunt, and this is a time when all political parties need to focus on extremism and what's happening. Mm. So, I mean, that wasn't exactly shown in the Dáil by anybody.
No.
And I think, well, look, if it's now that matter is dealt with in terms of whether or not the Justice Minister should continue on, well, now I'd like to see probably a little bit of unity, maybe, yeah, in terms of the seriousness of the matter at hand. Mm. So that would be something which I think they could and should probably move on to quite quickly.
But that doesn't that in its own way, though, illustrate the hypocrisy of Fine Gael spending the whole time shouting about Sinn Féin and their previous record? That if you can't, you spend the last 12 days saying what we need now is unity. People don't want division, they want unity. And the subtext of that is what unity behind me. So it's time that we all now rally together behind us, the ones in charge. If you want everyone to rally together, you can't spend 2.5 hours of Dáil time shouting about the lads on the other side. You should be talking in more constructive tones about what you're doing and how you will deal with a real and growing threat to public order, rather than saying like, ah, but you know, you guys in the IRA, need to be a bit more condensed than that.
I want to talk about a couple of the actual issues which sort of have resulted from the 23rd of November, but just on the politics point before we move on from it, is Helen McEntee, is she actually home and hosed in relation to this matter? Because we're still very early on from what actually happened, and in terms of, you know, whether or not the Gardaí had gotten this right in terms of how they've handled this matter, and the step-by-step incremental nature of some of these protests and violence that we've seen at protests for a long time now. It's a bit early on to say, okay, she's now secure in this and the government is in the clear with regards to how they tackle the far right and, you know, disorder in Dublin.
Yeah, well, again, this is another way in which politics moves at a different lane to the rest of the public. So politically speaking, because she has survived a motion of confidence in the Dáil, there can't be another one for 6 months. So short of there being some massive government collapsing scandal, nobody in the Dáil is allowed to try and pull the stunt again until the first week of June, if the government even survives that far. But as regards whether she is out of the woods, well, you know, patently not, because there's obviously a present threat to public order. There's still the same group of antagonists that might have instigated what happened 2 weeks ago might still do so again. Who knows what the trigger point or the boiling point for that might be, but there might well be one. And also, don't forget, by the way, the subplot of this week is that she's also been accused of misleading the Dáil over whether Twitter/X was taking down inflammatory material. She went into the Dáil last week and said that the officers in Store Street were trying to get material taken down off various sites. TikTok and Meta were perfectly playing ball, she was told, and that X wasn't. And she went into the Dáil and repeated that as gospel. Leo Varadkar also said, by the way, he was also at the same meeting and heard the same thing. But X says that as a matter of course, they weren't asked to take down anything until 4 days after the riots, and they were only asked to remove one post. So how can Helen McEntee say that they weren't complying if X say that they didn't receive any formal notices? Now, maybe it's an ambiguity of wording, but one would wonder why both Helen McEntee and Leo Varadkar came away with an impression that X said was not true. And who's the good faith actor there, and how did such a massive misunderstanding come to arise?
And can I ask you, was that the case that they had to be asked to take it down, though? Like, were TikTok and Meta had to be asked as well, or did some of them act of their own volition?
That could well be the semantic argument, which is a difference to it. But X said, we weren't asked to remove anything until Monday night. So how can Helen McEntee then have spoken to guards 2 days after the riots and be told that X wasn't cooperating when they hadn't been asked?
Well, we'll wait and see, because we need to figure out if what X says is true and what not. X, I still hate calling it X.
I know.
It sounds so stupid. It's called Twitter. It's called Twitter. People call it Twitter, okay? So Twitter put out a tweet in relation to what Helen McEntee had said. They said, this is inaccurate. We've proactively taken action on more than 1,230 pieces of content under our rules relating to the riots.
1,200?
Yeah.
So that's nothing.
And they said, we met with the Cumhachúin Éireann on November 24th, which is the day after the riot and whatnot, to discuss our response. The Gardaí did not make any formal requests to us until Monday the 27th. I'd love to know, I think if Twitter is serious about this, it should probably detail some of the material that it did take down. Or, you know, it says to take action rather than taking down as well. So whether or not they put up a little community notes flag or whatever it was, and given the material which was on Twitter.com and which was promoted by Twitter.com and which is paid for by Twitter.com and which people pay Twitter.com to put up on their website.
Yes, yeah.
You probably have to take, you know, a little pinch of salt with that, though.
Are you 1 week off from that? How are you finding it?
Absolutely great. It doesn't make an ounce of difference to my life.
But now that you're calling it Twitter, we can't call you an ex-user.
Yeah, you can't actually. But actually, something more seriously I want to talk about, because I was actually only chatting to a guy yesterday in relation to this. He's a guard who was on public order unit duty on the evening of the riots. And some people might have seen his report or his story. It was covered anonymously in a couple of the newspapers. Mm. He'd been badly injured, and he told me this himself a couple of weeks before, or well, just after the riots. He had basically had two toes broken at the time, is what he thought it was. He's since had one of his toes amputated, and the other one is still in bad nick as well. He's getting married this week, and honeymoon next week as well. He is quite devastated about the whole matter. So we're thinking about him. Because it's just a terrible time. He'd actually only been on to me literally before the riots. I think it was a couple of weeks ago, asking me about running tips because he was looking to do a half marathon.
Oh, wow.
And yeah.
Suddenly that's what happened.
This happened. God. So yeah, so that's a difficult one for him. And I think that anecdotally as well, like, it has been a tough time for a lot of the people who are on duty, whether that was in the Gardaí, Dublin Fire Brigade, you know, in the HSE, and a lot of nurses have reported a lot of problems that they had on the night as well. So yeah, there's a lot which has yet to be fully resolved as a result of all this.
Definitely. And I think just that point you make about him getting married this weekend, actually, you know, the knock-on impact it has to their friends and family, the people who love them as they go out onto the front line and work in these conditions. And we, you know, obviously think about the couple as they head into their wedding this weekend. We wish them the best of luck, but obviously it's a very difficult circumstance to be facing into your wedding on.
Well, the United Nations now says that there is nowhere left to go for people in Gaza, as Israel has said it's been engaged in some of the most intense fighting of the war so far, as it moves towards southern Gaza around the city of Khan Yunis, and then further on down south in Gaza as well. The devastation of this war, coming off the back of the extended humanitarian pauses that we did see for the prisoner and hostage exchange, I think it's probably dawning on the world just how bleak the situation is. It's probably worse than it ever has been coming off the back of those pauses, given the intensity of what we've seen. Like, we've talked before about what some of the Palestinian journalists have been sharing on Instagram. Mm. A lot of people are sharing what Motaz has been sharing over the last couple of days.
Oh, and his account has been so devastating this week. Yeah. It's been, I mean, but even it kind of makes you realise that as the storyteller on the front line, you know, sometimes it's easy to forget that he's living that as well, actually, and that it's his lived experience. Mm. You know,
it is. And I saw, when I was putting up on Instagram stories the other day, I described him as probably the most influential journalist in the world right now.
100%.
I think by a huge distance he is.
Yeah.
He has himself started to post about how he is probably going to have to stop doing updates as such because his own situation is so unsafe. He has reported gunfire and tank shells in the area where he has been in central and southern Gaza. It's taking a huge, huge risk to film and to shoot everything that he has been doing. And still, as Sky's diplomatic and international editor says, you know, journalists want to get in there. They're just not being allowed in. So these are the only people who are showing an independent look as to what's happening in Gaza.
That was actually a really important point. Was it Alex Crawford that was making that point?
It was
a really important point, because people are presuming that, oh, Gaza is just very difficult to get into, or because the food security or energy security is so weak in there that a lot of people are just dissuaded from going in. Actually, no, a lot of people can't get in because the primary way to access Gaza is by entering through Israel. And if Israel decides they won't facilitate you with access, there's nothing more you can do. I was just reflecting that this time last week we were talking about what was still at the time an extended ceasefire, and we were sort of hoping that one ceasefire might beget another. And actually, that made it all the more depressing when I think the first sentence you said, Richard, was that the UN now says there is nowhere safe to go.
Well,
just the gravity of that sentence, and how you know, maybe because our attention domestically, we might have been distracted for the last couple of weeks, you'd forget just how much this was becoming so much graver by the day. The idea there's nowhere safe to go, that they're handing out daily maps, sending people to purportedly safe areas, and then there's attacks there anyway. It's nowhere to go.
80% of people in Gaza, which is more than 1.8 million people, have left their homes, and now obviously a lot of those homes are no longer exist.
Don't exist.
Of course, at the start of the war, Israel told people to move to the south. Now that they're focusing their attacks on the south, you're effectively hemmed in a very, very small piece of land. Shelters are now almost non-existent. People are hiding in rubble in many cases. UN schools, UN clinics are completely, you know, under the cosh at this point in time. As well as that, you mentioned the maps and the sort of people have been given evacuation orders. People might have seen online one of the ways which Israel is doing this at this point in time is that they're publishing an online map, a grid system. So they've divided Gaza into 600 little boxes. Mm. And they're telling people in, say, box 314, out you go, evacuation order. And the only way to access this map is via QR code and online.
When connectivity
the
is
the vast
like
majority of Gaza
totally
had no
reliable.
Longer has power, nor do they have any internet connectivity. Mm. So a lot of clinics in there have been saying, well, this is like a macabre game of battleships. It's like, you know, which box are you going to move into to save your life when there's no guarantee that place won't be bombed either. So there is international pressure, I think, on Israel to sort of clarify what it's doing in terms of international humanitarian law. But this is, I think, things are, I think, in terms of actual attention from members of the public here on it, I think this period over the last week has probably been the most intense, I think, since the war began.
Yeah, I do think so. And I think it's really interesting to see people who, you know, wouldn't necessarily work in news and current affairs or in this particular field, you know, really just posting up online that they feel so uncomfortable about talking about anything else at the moment because they just feel like, what else can we talk about? What else can we say? And, you know, people who would normally share certain types of content, say on Instagram, that they're just like, listen, I just can't do this week. I can't, you know, I'm opening up my app and I'm seeing all these pictures. And going back to the point that you're making about that important account that we're getting from the front line inside Gaza from Palestinian journalists, you know, when we see, say, you know, foreign correspondents getting access to Gaza in the last few weeks, it has generally been under the supervision of the IDF. And it's important to say that. And, you know, CNN has been really clear in saying, just so you know, the report you're about to see has been pre-approved by the IDF, basically. Not
so pre-approved, what does that mean? Pre-approved, does that mean that the IDF...
Pre-approved is the wrong word, actually. Sorry, it's the wrong word. It's more that, like, these pictures were cleared by the IDF after we shot them, and also our script had to be sent for clearance from the IDF. So, you know, if one of us was in there covering this, that we would have to, you know, go with your camera person, you are brought around by an IDF soldier to film bits that you're basically brought to. You're not allowed to step outside of the zones that you're brought
to. You're not allowed to speak to
people. So, like, in a lot of ways, like, it's a very sanitized, but it's a very monitored and controlled, but like you can understand why the likes of CNN and Sky will take that access, because of course you'll take any access you can get, but it's an ethical dilemma, and it's totally not the same as the coverage you're going to get from is it Mozart, is how you pronounce it?
Motaz.
I would highly recommend following Motaz, but I would also give a health warning on that it's very raw, and it's the footage is, you know, it's just very upfront, and it's literally as it's happening. And that in itself is difficult to consume for people. But yeah, you're right, Richard. I do think that, like, even people listening to the podcast now, I'm sure will probably feel the same way, that the longer this goes on, the more devastating and upsetting it is, and the more sort of helpless people feel, because you think, how can we all stand by and see this unfolding and have no power to stop it? I get that. I really get
that. And that's a particularly grave aspect of what's happened in the last few weeks, because at the start of all of this, you know, there was the criticism that the likes of Ursula von der Leyen had been unqualified in her support for Israel, and that the United States, which is a traditional ally, was four square behind them as well. There has been that notable uptick in, like, the US rhetoric about all of this now, that, like, this has to be qualified with minimizing civilian loss of life and civilian damage. And Israel just now seems to be the point. This shouldn't be seen as an inflammatory statement, where Israel is just disregarding those calls from its greatest ally, the US, and from the rest of the world, where it still sees this as an existential thing, that it can't exist safely alongside Hamas anymore, and that it just won't stop until the whole thing has been obliterated, by which I mean Hamas and all of its infrastructure, and everything else is just collateral damage to them, far from that. But the idea that they're now so emboldened, where even their staunchest ally doesn't appear to be able to moderate their stance at all, is really gravely worrying. And just on the point about Gaza being split into 600 boxes, there was a very striking cartoon, I think from The Guardian.
It was in The Guardian,
The Advent calendar. Lest it be forgotten how sensitive a time of the year this is for everyone in the Middle East, that Gaza in one of those cartoons has been split into an advent calendar to almost replicate as if, oh, today is the 6th, today's the 7th, today's the day that you can move out of this area because we're going to blast it to smithereens. Yeah. It's just dreadful.
And I think as well, you know, it's actually the point I would make as well is that, you know, we had sort of moments of happiness seeing like Ibrahim and his family come home, for example, and Emily Ham being released. And you can understand that there were moments where people, you know, felt that the progress was being made. But the truth is, like, they're temporary lights at the end of a very dark tunnel, actually. And, you know, it goes back to the point we've made many weeks here on the podcast that, like, the untold trauma that people have experienced, like, it's not about today, and it's about this long-term implication for the human beings at the center of this, I think is just we just don't know. We just don't know yet how bad that's going to be.
Yeah, and we don't know how long it's going to take. I was reading some headlines saying that, you know, Israel preparing for a year-long war in Gaza. So look, we're going to keep an eye on it. Obviously, we have a couple more podcasts before the end of the year. I'm sure it'll figure in those as well. So do stay up to date with us on Virgin Media News. Zara, you've been working on a couple of things domestically. Today, the news of 4 new special needs schools are opening. So that is something positive.
It is something positive. And we've talked a lot about school places. Mm-hmm. Gavin, in particular, you've been really clear in talking about that as well, school places for children with special needs. So 4 new special needs schools are going to open for the academic year next year. They are going to be in Limerick City, in Enfield in County Mead, in Gorey in County Wexford, and in the South Kildare area. So this is good news in terms of, I suppose, investment in education and equal opportunities for all the kids, Gav.
Yeah, so next year it's 120 pupils across all 4 of those, but that's with a view to expanding over these future years, because generally speaking, when you start a new school, you'll only start at the infant grades and then you'll work your way up. So you fast forward 5 or 6 years, you could have an enrollment of several hundred pupils in those schools. And just the difference that makes, because special school places are so difficult to come by, and there's so many stories of people getting bussed across cities. As someone who is able to avail of a special needs education, you get free door-to-door transport to recognise the fact that your journey might be so far. And there's so many stories of people that are driving from like the north end of the M50 into the city centre or out to the opposite side of the city altogether. And that's just in Dublin to access special educational places. So the idea that there might be finally more of them and new schools showing up with new roll numbers can only be a good thing going forward. And as long as they are supported to keep doing what they're doing, is one rare instance where there is a bit of a bright light there.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it definitely is. And, I think it's kind of, in all the times that we do criticise the government, I think it's kind of technology that this is obviously a positive development. And that announcement was made by the minister today. And so that's a little bit of good news.
Tell me, you're also working on the issue of traveller mental health, which is a huge issue which has never gone away. It probably has never had as much spotlight as it needed to. But what exactly were you working on with that?
So I just think it's, and I actually want to say, we'd love to come back to this again for a bonus episode. And I think we will.
Yeah.
I think
we
definitely will, because I actually think this is like not just a mention, it should be a deeper conversation. Because for a lot of people listening, you may not realise that obviously mental health is a crisis across all of society, but particularly within the traveller community. You will see latest statistics showing that 90% of travellers will report dealing with mental health issues, and 82% of travellers have experienced, you know, issues relating to suicide, whether they've lost a loved one or, you know, so it's a huge issue within the community, actually. And there's a disproportionate effect for travellers, even compared to people in the settled community. So yesterday there was a demonstration, Tuesday was a demonstration at Leinster House, calling for access to services. You know, it's just even trying to get things like, it starts with basic things, right? So for example, you know, Mags Casey, one of the spokespeople for the National Traveller Mental Health Network, was telling me that it's even things like integration is a starting point, right? So it's like getting access to join sports clubs, be part of communities, be involved. That in itself promotes positive mental health, and it, you know, allows people to feel more accepted within the environment that they live in. You know, so that's a starting point. But also then crucially, when it gets to the end of the system where there's a need there for, you know, counselling and supports and actually, you know, positive mental health interventions, that none of it is there. They're saying that they've been have promises from government since 2020 that haven't been implemented. And they are so frustrated. And, you know, Mags Casey said to me yesterday, she said, like, Sarah, what do you think it is? Like, why do you think they're ignoring us? And like, the sad reality, you know, is that a lot of groups, not just this, feel the same way about government. Like, how many groups do we meet outside the gates of Leinster House week after week after week who actually say the same thing? They ask the same questions. I've said before, how many times do I meet families of kids with special needs who are fighting for the same things all the time? And I meet them year after year, and I go, so I completely kind of understood what she was saying in terms of that frustration. But looking at the parents of young Patrick McDonough, who was a 12-year-old boy who took his own life 2 years ago, Patrick McDonough's parents, Michelle and Patrick Sr., were there yesterday, and they were talking about the fact that young Patrick was being bullied relentlessly. And why was he being bullied? Because of his identity. He was being bullied because of who he was. And I asked a lot of the travellers that I met yesterday the same question. I asked them, do you think it's more difficult to be a traveller in Ireland today than it was in the 90s? 20 years ago, 30 years ago, do you think it's more difficult? And they said, it's not getting any easier. Mm. And that is actually a damning indictment on all of us as a society. That is the fact that it's not getting any easier. The fact that, you know, travellers had, is it ethnic recognition?
Yeah, I was there on the night. It was 2016 or 17 where Enda Kenny formally recognised them as an ethnic minority within their own country in the Dáil. And this was, albeit didn't involve any particular measures, it was kind of seen as this great, you know, panacea where absolutely, it might suddenly be the recognition of their needs and that there might then be concrete steps afterwards to address that. But evidently, not
at all. They really hoped that it would. They really hoped that this would be the turning point, that it would make a huge difference. And they do feel left down. They do feel disappointed that nothing has changed. You know, Mags Casey herself, who I say is a campaigner, has buried 29 members of her immediate and extended family as a direct result of suicide. So look, it's an ongoing fight for services, and they're similar to other groups in that regard. But I think, you know, for people to understand that when you see 90% of people in a community saying they've been affected by mental health and not actually getting access to services, it's just really not good enough.
No. Yeah. As you say, Zara, we'll probably come back and do a full bonus on
it. I'd love to do that. Yeah, I'd love to do that.
Moving on, though, to something which a lot of people have been looking for us to cover more extensively, and that is COP28. So this is, of course, where world leaders have come together to discuss addressing the challenge of climate change. Here's a clip that we have from a Zoom call dating from last month from the president of COP28, this year's COP summit, speaking with our own former president, Mary Robinson.
You lead on phasing out fossil fuel with just transition, as I've said.
I accepted to come to this meeting to have a sober and a mature conversation. I'm not in any way signing up to any discussion that is alarmist. I am here factual and I respect the science. And there is no science out there or no scenario out there that says that the phase out of fossil fuel is what's going to achieve 1.5. 1.5 is my North Star. And a phase down and a phase out of fossil fuel, in my view, is inevitable.
There you have it, folks. Courtesy of the Guardian newspaper, the president of COP28 says that there's no science which says that the complete phase out of fossil fuels is necessary to achieve the goal of preventing the death of our planet.
What a demented comment.
Should we note for the record that he is not merely the president of COP28?
It's pretty pertinent that he isn't just that he has another job.
Yes, which is that he's the chief executive of one of the state oil and gas companies for the UAE. So he's a man with slightly conflicted loyalties.
So he's come back now. In fairness to the man, he has come back and he has sort of said, look, he said it was taken out of context, as he would. And he said that, you know, that he thinks there's been disinformation and misinformation. He says that he's, you know, he's not in denial of any of the science. He says that they were misinterpreted. But this has provoked a huge amount of controversy at a time when people do not take world leaders seriously on climate issues.
Yeah, Mary Robinson's face in that clip was just, I mean, it was quite polite, but you could tell she was probably like, what is going on here?
Quietly seething. Idea. I mean, like, so this is the week where we were told that this year, after a whole other chain of years where that year was the warmest year on record ever, this is going to be another year where we're on record ever. And we're now told that if the goal to try and limit the most extreme aspects of climate change is to limit the average warming of the Earth to 1.5 degrees, that actually we're now on course to basically reach 3 degrees, which would mean double that, which would mean such hostile weather that many parts of the Earth simply will become uninhabitable. And for the person then to be leading the global summit directly on the heels of this news to say, there's no science to say that phasing out fossil fuels will help that now. Like, science is fairly clear that the introduction and the mass, like, rampant consumption of fossil fuels has got us where we are. At the very least, like, what was the Albert Einstein's idea of insanity was repeating the same thing over and over, expecting something different to happen. Yeah. Like, even if there weren't any science, which, by the way, there is, wouldn't it be a good idea to just try something different anyway?
Yeah.
Is COP, like, what are your thoughts on COP? I suspect you might have thoughts on this. I mean, it's kind of like when people give out about the UN General Assembly every year and say, it's a talking shop and everyone just goes and hangs out and claps each other in the back and says whatever. But actually, it is about diplomatic speed dating, we call it every year. But what about COP? Is it climate speed dating? What's the point of it?
It's been so successful, really, in addressing the greatest crisis of our lifetime. And I would really love to take the opportunity to applaud all of the brave leaders who have really taken the action that we need at this trying time. So well done to them. Al Gore, former vice president of the US, pointing out, and there's been a lot of reporting by the BBC and other organizations over the last number of weeks in the lead up to COP about the activities of both the hosts, the UAE and Saudi Arabia as well, in terms of what they've been doing to prevent the phase out of fossil fuels, because obviously their economies are completely dependent on it thus far until they're, you know, figure something else out. With relation to the president of COP28 and his, you know, his day job, basically, Al Gore said the industry, i.e. the oil industry, is way more effective at capturing politicians than they are at capturing emissions. So there has been a huge pushback in terms of people who are prominent speakers about climate issues, probably the most influential voices about climate issues. And they feel that this is a mask slipping moment, that people who should and have the authority and have the power to do better and to influence global climate policy. It is mad. It is mad in the extreme that an oil company president is the president of COP28. I know he defended himself saying he's full belief of the science and that, you know, we have to keep it under 1.5 degrees in terms of warming. And he said that he was an engineer, so therefore he gets science, which is the wrong type of science. But there's been so many different groups which have come out now and said this is a complete joke. And how can they ever have faith in the process of, you know, world leaders and global summits to address these matters again?
Well, maybe this might be then the tipping point, is such an overused phrase, but if it's the point at which we sort of, you know, reckon with the reality that some of the world's major petrostates do have this outlook, that you have to recognize some of the elephants in the room before you actually make any progress. One perhaps closing note of relative optimism. I was in Glasgow 2 years ago for COP26 when that was on. And I remember the discussion at the time about what they called loss and damage, the idea that you would compensate some of the countries that are worst affected by rising sea levels and extreme weather and whatnot. And 2 years ago, that idea was laughed out of the room. Absolutely not going to happen. COP28 now, it's firmly on the agenda, and there might be concrete steps when it finishes to actually do that. So these things do happen like painfully, painfully slowly. But every year you talk about it, you do get it 1 year closer to maybe happening.
I really hope you're watching the telly and you can see Richard's face, because he's absolutely furious.
They're trying to move us on from the segment. Okay. I just want to finish off with one more quote from Al Gore. He says, "From the moment this absurd masquerade began, this has been clearly discovered as the most brazen conflict of interest in the history of climate negotiations." He's finished off saying, as the science does, that the world needs to phase out fossil fuels as quickly as possible.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Zara, have you got Riz? Have you ever Rizzed anyone up?
Excuse me.
Rizzed anybody up?
Zara spoken for.
Would you know what I'm talking about?
I have
if
no
I said
idea. That? I genuinely, really? I feel that's quite bad, but I don't know what that is.
Gavin.
I am a happily married man for 6 years, Richard.
You'll have to exercise some Riz at some point. Yeah.
Oh, God.
I don't think I'd be... God, wow. We should explain what Riz means.
Yes.
There's a reason why we're talking about whether people have Riz.
Riz is the Oxford Dictionary's word of the year for 2023. It is internet slang for romantic appeal or charm. You know, good bit of flirtatiousness. I mean, it's shortened from the middle bit of charisma.
I would have said charisma. Oh, yeah. Riz. Yeah.
So that's Riz.
Yeah.
Very popular with youngsters online using other apps, including TikTok
and
whatnot.
I thought we were youngsters online.
We're well past that.
We're not, okay.
We're well past that. So but that is the word of the year. It is actually rare, because I feel like any time they've done this previously, it's not a word that people use. Do you remember they used Youthquake was one of them?
Wouldn't you think that when the internet
garbage is what it was.
What's a youthquake? What does that mean?
There was a big youth uprising and there's loads of protests caused by young people.
Like Arab Spring, but just only instigated by young people. But you'd think
young people having opinions. Well, God,
when they introduce or when they decide that something is the word of the year, shouldn't it have a kind of a long-standing resonance? It shouldn't just be something that refers to a flash in the pan.
What other words are on the list?
There was a short list of words. Beige flag, right?
I get that. Yeah.
That is a character trait that indicates that a partner or a potential partner is boring or lacks originality. Something which is, you know, it shows a blend.
Formerly known as vanilla.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Situationship. That's one everyone.
Yeah, everyone knows.
That actually possibly could have been the actual winner. I think that one's been more.
I think situationship is the most. I mean, it's very descriptive of the thing that it is, I would say.
But it also, it's not a
borderline onomatopoeia.
It's a thing that has existed for several years, though. Like that word's been around.
It's not new.
But it did capture. I think it was probably more prominently used. Heat. So there was a couple of more serious words as well. Heat dome, relating to, you know, a persistent high pressure weather system over a particular geographic area. De-influencing, which is actually an interesting one.
I see a lot of that now.
But you see, I don't think I've ever seen the word used, but it
never
makes
sense. Never seen the word used, but I see the action happening.
Like the idea of people shedding.
Where someone actually
the...
comes online and is like, this is actually not good, don't buy this.
Is that not in its own way influencing?
No, because like most people who are getting paid to like sell you something are not saying bad things about it.
Whereas somebody just a legitimate person going on and saying...
I would say de-influencing is closer to actual consumer style journalism. Like, because I mean, it's where someone takes something, they genuinely review it and go, actually, this bit about this is good, but this bit's not that good. So make up your own
Somebody saying that a certain high value, high end brand name air wrap hair dryer isn't, or hairstylist or curling wand thing isn't actually very good.
I've been saying for a while, I'm not mad about it.
One of the other words of the year.
€500 for your girlfriend's Christmas, just saying.
One of the other words of the year was Swifty, which of course is an enthusiastic fan of the singer Taylor Swift.
Time Person of the Year, 2023.
Gavin Riley revealing Taylor Swift, the Time Person of the Year.
I revealed it to the three of us just now. I didn't reveal
it. Who was it last year? Was it Zelensky last year?
I think it was Zelensky last year. Because I think one thing which is important is that...
It was Zelensky and the spirit of Ukraine. We should come back to Zelensky next week. Zelensky's in bother.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll come back to it. But Taylor Swift, I think, is a worthy winner of Person of the Year.
Well,
I think you can't always have to give it in terms of, you know, a person of political resonance. I think sometimes pop culture and like just the scale of the achievements or the things that, or the attention that was garnered by this person is probably worth it.
Yeah.
But pretty serious.
Other words of the year by alternative lexicons, Merriam-Webster have described this year's word of the year as authentic, which is maybe a nod to de-influencing. Actually.
Oh, you mean like as in like...
Yeah, well, not alone just in celebrity culture and influencing, but also with reference to AI and how some culture is sort of artificially generated, that actually there is a value to
authenticity.
There you go.
It is a commodity, all right. What was last year's one? Last year's one was Goblin Mode. Do you remember Goblin Mode?
No, I don't know what that is.
It was a slang term describing unapologetically self-indulgent, lazy, slovenly, or greedy behavior. Basically, people would say, I'm going into Goblin Mode because I'm off work for 2 weeks or whatever.
Post-lockdown behavior. But lockdown.
Yeah, just not interested in looking good or whatever, just staying at home.
Oh, goblin mode. Okay.
Used to call that exam face back in our day.
Exam face?
Yeah. Where when you're going through your college finals and you're not paying any attention to your physical look.
I would like to wrap up the segment with reference to November, Collins Dictionary. I'm not promoting one dictionary over the other.
Right.
When I tell you how bad their word of the year was.
Other dictionaries are available.
Collins Dictionary revealed their word of the year was artificial intelligence. It's not a word, it's two.
It's two words.
And it's also not something which just existed now. Boo, Collins Dictionary. You've been found out.
No, Collins,
no.
Of course, this week marks the funeral of the late and great Shane McGowan, the former lead singer of the Pogues. But what is interesting about what's happened this year, and he will, of course, be very much missed, especially at this time of year. Mm. Christmas Day, of course, his birthday. But probably the most...
Christmas Day, his birthday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No way.
And this is why I say this.
Phenomenal.
In the UK charts, Fairy Tale of New York has never been Christmas number one, right? Given how popular that is as a Christmas song, it was beaten to number two by, I think it was Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
In its original year, 1987.
Yeah.
Talk amongst yourselves while I go and look that
up.
The year before I was born.
I wish we'd done our research before this pod. Do your research. Do your own research.
I think it's nicer when it's alluded to.
But yeah, so there's a big campaign now. Because Lad Baby, I don't know if you've heard of Lad Baby. It's way too long. Lad Baby had five consecutive Christmas number ones in the UK, and they were all about sausage rolls. It was just complete crap.
2 years ago, Lad Baby was in competition with Ed Sheeran and Elton John, who had a legitimate Christmas song to be Christmas number one. And because Elton and Ed Sheeran were not going to win, they collaborated with Lad Baby, who was doing a knockoff of the same song where he was talking about wishing sausage rolls for everyone. And Elton John and Ed Sheeran's legitimate Christmas song was beaten into number two by their own collaboration with Lad Baby, taking the piss out of their own song.
Okay,
actually,
right.
The Pet Shop Boys Always On My Mind is what...
Which is a banger.
Yeah, great song, fair play.
Yeah, fair.
But what's interesting then about what's actually then in contention, because Lad Baby's not doing it anymore this year. Lad Baby has stepped down.
Okay.
The iconic Lad Baby.
It's like Michael Schumacher giving up Formula One.
The three songs which are in contention for Christmas number one are all... ancient. There is Fairy Tale of New York, which is very much on the rise. Last Christmas by Wham.
One of my faves. Love it. Love it. Love
and
it.
Obviously Mariah Carey as well.
An icon.
So all three of these songs are
straight away, I feel bad not saying that it would be Fairy Tale of New York for me, but Wham Last Christmas is just, I love it.
Mm. Like, what is it, what difference does it make to Wham to get Christmas number one this year?
Isn't George Michael's birthday on Christmas Day as well?
George Michael's anniversary is Christmas Day.
Oh, sorry, it's his anniversary. Yeah. Oh, dear. Okay.
But first of all, the fact that the sort of three contenders are all like 90s or later, does that not just like speak terribly
just
of modern
tells
music?
You. It tells you, Gavin, it tells you that the 90s were just the best.
No, but just, what it tells you that modern music is crap if the last five have been lad babies.
Was it?
No,
yeah, well,
last,
or
it's the late 80s.
It's the 80s.
So Mariah would have been the 90s. And then
you
then
love you love Last Christmas.
I think it is my favourite Christmas
song. You love it.
Absolutely.
And you do a lovely version of
it. It's No, The Darkness, Christmas Time, Don't Let the Bells End for 2003.
However,
I think we should sing Last Christmas on our podcast Christmas special. I'm saying it here.
To tune in after Christmas, you know.
Okay.
I don't want to put them off, but
I knew you were going to say no. That's why I've asked you on camera.
I think it would be a fitting thing to happen for the Pogues and Fairy Tale New York to get number one.
Yeah, I know.
The way that people can help, because people maybe don't realise that this is how it's changed in the last few years, is that streaming now counts towards the charts. Previously, the idea was, are you going into a shop and buying a single? Now, because the advent of the iTunes era where you download a whole album, singles are kind of broken. So streaming counts. That's the reason why Wham and Mariah are charting without ever having to put more singles in the shop, or that you don't even have to go and download it from iTunes for 99 cents, because if you just watch it on YouTube,
and just
counts.
Play it loads basically on your Spotify.
So there you go. That'd be the easiest way to do it. Easy way to achieve it is just get your Spotify premium and just leave the Pogues on repeat for
that. What other Christmas songs are you playing at the moment in your car?
That's a good question. A couple of really old soul-y sort of ones. I haven't really
listened
to
Otis Redding, White Christmas on a lot.
Otis Redding is a great Christmas singer.
It's a great one.
Yeah, I have a couple of others I can't really think of. Like, it's about very like
Driving Home for Christmas, I adore.
There's that low one which was in the OC called Just Like Christmas. Great song.
Send that to me.
You can't break out the Chris Rea too early though. Yeah, like
I love Chris Rea. No, I'm driving around Dublin for Christmas.
It's December 6th.
I don't care.
It's not driving over. Well, look, it's a song.
But then it's really special when you actually drive home for Christmas. It's my favourite.
We should give the last words in relation to Fairy Tale New York to Victoria Mary Clark, Shane McGowan's wife, who told BBC Radio 4's Today programme that she's very much in favour of Fairy Tale of New York finally taking this long awaited honour. She said it would be nice, wouldn't it? It should be the Christmas number one. It absolutely should. I'm very much in favour of that. It is interesting that there is no contemporary challenges, and there often is, because it is a big, as you say, Gavin, it's a big streaming.
But, like, Simon Cowell broke it, basically, because this was the whole model of Pop Idol and Pop Stars. The idea was that basically you were being released to be
Christmas
number one.
I love that for the second week in a row we're talking about this.
Nobody released.
I always remember One True Voice and their Lost to Girls Aloud back in 2003.
Well, look, I hope nobody releases them in the period between now and Christmas number one. But yeah, we're winding down the year. We've one more normal podcast to do, I think.
Yeah, one more normal podcast next week, and then we are recording a very special Christmas special for you
with some special guests.
Word special multiple times. It's going to be brilliant.
Right, time to go. We'll be back next week. Thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for listening and for watching us. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.